السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. صلى الله وسلم عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا رسول الله، صلى الله وسلم عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله، يا غريب يا مظلوم يا شهيد كربلاء، يا ليتنا كنا معكم سادتي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. قال الله تعالى في محكم كتابه الكريم: بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولا تركنوا إلى الذين ظلموا فتمسكم النار وما لكم من دون الله من أولياء ثم لا تنصرون. God states in the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim: and do not incline toward the wrongdoer, lest the fire touch you, and you will have no protector apart from God. Thereafter, you will not be helped. Amanna billah, sadaqallahu al-aliyyul azim. Once again, let us enliven our hearts, our minds, and our gathering with the remembrance of the Holy Prophet and his purified progeny. Sallu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Despite the paramount effects of the Ashura episode on the sensibilities, on the minds and hearts of Muslims throughout history, over the course of Islamic history, despite the huge effects of this episode on Muslims, today we sometimes see some devastating attempts by some Sunnis and Shiites to reduce Imam Hussein, to restrict Imam Hussein to a symbol of Shi'ism. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is reduced by some. He is restricted by some through various means, through sensationalist means, through reductionism. So for example, we find that some Shi'is are quite possessive of Imam Hussein. They claim Imam Hussein as their own. And they do so sometimes, especially at the expense of other Muslims. They consider Imam Hussein to be theirs and theirs alone. He does not belong to other Muslims of other persuasions or schools of thought. And some even go further than this, to blame Sunnis for what happened on the day of Ashura. They point the finger of blame and they say it is the Sunnis who killed Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura, and that Yazid represents Sunnism. Some go to this extent that they equate the killing of Imam Hussein and the place of Yazid with Sunnism, and that they claim that Imam Hussein represents their own school of thought, represents Shi'ism alone. On the other hand, we have some Sunnis who consider Ashura to be strictly a Shi'i affair. The commemoration of Ashura, the commemoration of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to be specific and restricted to Shi'ism. And so sometimes we find that there are many Sunnis who themselves, they do not commemorate Ashura. They do not remember Imam Hussein. They give no time or effort to commemorating this event and to commemorating the values and the objectives of this event. And they expect others, other Sunnis also, to do the same. Sometimes they are astonished when they see other Sunnis commemorating Ashura and commemorating Imam Hussein. And some of them go even further than this to blame the Shi'is for the massacre of Karbala. I've heard this often, this argument, often, that those to blame for the massacre of Ashura in Karbala, the killing of the grandson of the Prophet, were the Shia themselves. The followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib themselves, they are the ones who betrayed Imam Hussein and they are the ones who killed Imam Hussein. Some go further and suggest that Imam Hussein was killed by the sword of his grandfather. That they thus reduce him and they restrict Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And so, knowingly or unknowingly, proponents, adherents of various schools, be it Sunni or Shi'i, we find that each attempts to reduce Imam Hussein alayhi salam. They attempt to reduce Ashura, and thus it must be firmly stated and restated that we should never succumb to the false and the ignorant and dangerous attempts to reduce Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the glorious status of Imam Hussein, and the sublime values that he represents. We should not surrender to these efforts. We should not be misinformed and misguided to think that Imam Hussein only belongs to one school of thought or one tradition within Islam. In fact, Imam Hussein belongs not just to all of the Muslims, but he belongs to all of humanity. Imam Hussein belongs to all of humanity. The lessons that we take from the Ashura episode, from the movement of Imam Hussein, those values, they are lessons and values for all. Imam Hussein represents all those who are freedom loving, all those who are justice seeking. Anyone who yearns for freedom, freedoms from the shackles of tyranny, freedoms, the shackles of indecency, all those who seek justice against injustice and oppression and all that is wrong, they seek inspiration from Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein belongs to all, and this is why we find that Imam Hussein has been commemorated not only by Shi'is, not only by the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, not only by Sunni Muslims, but Imam Hussein has also been commemorated and remembered by non-Muslims, many, throughout history. There are many examples. One primary and famous example is the example of Gandhi. Gandhi is famously said to have claimed that he sought inspiration from Imam Hussein. He learned from Imam Hussein how to be victorious while being oppressed. He was inspired by Imam Hussein. Many others are inspired, Christians, Jews, even those belonging to no faith tradition, they sought inspiration because they realized the value of Imam Hussein. They realized the objectives and the lessons that are drawn from the life and legacy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And so Imam Hussein should be treated as such, should be treated as a universal figure, a figure that represents everyone and belongs to everyone. When we introduce Imam Hussein, we should introduce Imam Hussein as such, one that everyone can be inspired from, that everyone can benefit from. When we invite, when we teach about Imam Hussein, we should invite our friends, invite our loved ones, invite those who we associate with, regardless of their school of thought, regardless of their religious persuasion, regardless of their background. The message of Imam Hussein is one that is inclusive. And this is why, in particular, I am very much inspired by those projects that seek to educate the masses, the people, and they seek to do so through Imam Hussein and the values of Imam Hussein. One such project is one that many of us might be aware of, is the campaign that is known as Who is Hussein? Which has received global recognition in different parts of the world, and which does so much work. Just recently I saw a really beautiful clip coming out of Chicago, came out of the news cycle from Chicago, of the organization, the chapter in that city, and how they contribute to the well-being of society. How? By providing school supplies for children, those who are in need, those who cannot afford school supplies. We all know this is important, right? Every year, at the beginning of the school year, it's expected that the children, students, they go and they stock up on school supplies. Sometimes all sorts, right? They want 12 glue sticks, right? They want, you know, 17 notebooks. All of these things, it's expected. And it's kind of exciting. If you think about it, it's exciting. Of course, from the perspective of the children, not from the perspective of the parents, because they have to spend a lot of money on it, right? But it's something that's expected. Some are not able. Some are not in a financial status that they're able to purchase school supplies. And so this organization, what they have done is that they have purchased backpacks. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was about 350 backpacks or 300 backpacks filled with school supplies. And it was distributed to those children and those families who are in need. This is the message of Imam Hussein. The message of Imam Hussein, as I mentioned, the message of Imam Hussein was one to call for goodness, to reform society. Part of reforming society means that every aspect of society, every group is one that is living at peace and living well-ordered. Not one group at the expense of another group. And so when we teach about Imam Hussein, when we invite to Imam Hussein, we should be inclusive. Because Imam Hussein belongs to everyone. Imam Hussein belongs to humanity. And thus, to those of the followers of Ahlul Bayt, the Shia, who seem to be possessive, overly possessive, who think that Imam Hussein belongs only to them and represents only them and none others, I would simply say two things. The first is that we have to go back and look at the message of the Imam himself. What did he proclaim? We've mentioned in the past few nights the mission statement of Imam Hussein. We've looked at various aspects of it. And we highlighted that one of the important clauses is the Imam's announcement that he rose up to seek reform of what? لطلب الإصلاح في أمتي جدي محمد صلى الله عليه وآله. So the Imam here is announcing reform of what? Reform of one community? He's saying his objective was to reform the nation of the Prophet. meaning all of the Muslims, the entire Muslim community, in its entirety. This was his objective. Nowhere do we have in the historical records, among the sayings of the Imams or Imam Hussein himself, or any description that restricts his objective to being one only related to Shi'ism or the Shia. The Imam never says, this is a Shi'i objective. This is an objective, only one that is restricted to the school of Ahlul Bayt or the values of the school of Ahlul Bayt. No. The Imam says, I seek reform of the nation of my grandfather, the community in its entirety. This was the objective of the Imam. This is the first point. The second point related is the importance, and I mentioned this in my first night, in my first lecture, regarding the importance and the significance of history, understanding history, knowing history, not just reading surface level, but having an in-depth understanding of history. One of the things that is very important for us to consider and to be aware of is that when we come to the history of Islam, especially the very early history of Islam, the first few decades of Islam, the first few decades after the death of the Prophet, when we come to the various groups that arose, when you read about the history, you find that there were many different trends, various theological leanings, legal leanings, and so on and so forth. So the groups that we refer to, the sectarian groups, especially the sectarian groups, and the identities of these groups were in large part fluid. It was not until later on, a couple of centuries later, that they really crystallized. They became hardened, the identity of certain groups, that you have group A or group B or group C, and this group specifically believes in and practices A, B, C, and so on and so forth. In the early, especially the very early period of Islamic history, there was a lot of fluidity. And so it was not a matter of black and white. It was not a matter of only Shi'i and Sunni. In fact, it was not until later that groups like the term Sunni is short for what? Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah. This term and this group that is identified as Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah was a later development. It did not occur in the early, very early period. And even some of the groups within Shi'ism, there was a lot of fluidity, brothers and sisters. So it's important for us to be historically accurate. This is why it's so important for us to read the history. Some matters were not just black and white. There was a lot of gray going on, a lot of gray area going on. So this is in regards to those who are possessive of Imam Hussein. They think that Imam Hussein belongs only to themselves at the exclusion of other groups of Muslims. To those Sunnis who assume that Imam Hussein is a Shi'i affair, that the commemoration of Ashura, that the commemoration of the tragedy of the Ahlul Bayt, and especially the tragedy of Imam Hussein and his family and companions, this is restricted only to the followers of Ahlul Bayt, only to the Shia. To them, I say simply that if you go back and you read your own history and the history of your scholarly tradition, you will find that most of your major scholars, they also acknowledged Ashura. They acknowledged the suffering and the massacre of Imam Hussein and his family members and his companions. And they opposed and condemned Yazid explicitly. This may come as a surprise to some. May come as a surprise to some. Those who are the followers of Ahlul Bayt have a certain image. And even those who belong to the Sunni school, they have a certain image, a certain perception. And so it may come as a surprise that most Sunni scholars also condemned Yazid. Most Sunni scholars opposed his actions and they acknowledged Ashura and the tragedy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this is why tonight I'd like to spend a few minutes, not to get too much into detail, we're restricted in time and scope. But to spend a few minutes to discuss some points regarding historically Muslim views on Yazid, the place of Yazid, the place of Ashura and Imam Hussein, and how they viewed these incidents, how they viewed these personalities, so that we get a clearer picture. We understand, and we understand what is at stake today. By understanding this history and this tradition, we understand what is at stake today. And when we say Muslim views, who are we referring to? We understand the views of Muslims through the sources that we have, and the sources that we have are the scholarly sources. How do we know who believed what? How things went about? We have sources. We have historic sources, we have theological sources, legal sources, books on hadith, and so on and so forth, that were written and composed by the scholars of the various traditions. When we come to these sources, the scholars and their works, and we look at and examine specifically this issue of their views, Muslim scholarly views regarding Yazid and Imam Hussein and Ashura, we find three major trends. Again, this is, in a way, I try to simplify this because there's a lot more discussion that can be had. We can spend several nights, several lectures talking about all of the nuances. But overall, just to give you sort of an introduction, an overall picture, there are three major trends when it comes to Muslim views regarding this issue. One trend is those who vehemently condemned and considered Yazid to be a kafir, to be a non-believer, or considered him to be a munafiq, a hypocrite. This is one view. They vehemently condemned Yazid, and they considered him to be outside the pale of Islam, or to be a hypocrite. And here, we see that virtually all Shi'i scholars, or scholars belonging to the school of Ahlul Bayt, they adopted this position. They all condemned Yazid. They considered him to be outside the fold of Islam. And they point to evidence. What is their evidence for this? Their evidence is simply, first and foremost, his actions. That when you go back and you study the sources, the historical records, the books of hadith and so on, the biographies, that they tell us that Yazid was an indecent and immoral person. That he performed all sorts of indecent acts. But that also he engaged in major crimes. And among these crimes was the massacre, the order to massacre Imam Hussein and his family members and companions. Number one. Number two, to place a siege. He ordered, directly ordered, that a siege be placed on the city of Medina. This was after Ashura. On the city of Medina, it's known as Waq'at al-Harra, where a siege was placed for several days, and the army of Yazid, they entered into the city of Medina, and they raped, and they pillaged, and they killed, and they tortured. This is number two. And number three, his order of his army to proceed to Mecca, to the holy mosque, Al-Masjid al-Haram, to attack the holy mosque, because in the holy mosque was Abdullah ibn Zubayr, who also had resisted Yazid. These three major events, they took place during the reign of Yazid. Yazid reigned for how long? How long? 3 years. He was caliph, he was ruler for 3 years. In these 3 years, his reign began with the massacre of Imam Hussein, and then proceeded to Medina, and proceeded to Mecca. These were major crimes. So they point to this. They say that his actions, his direct involvement in these heinous crimes, it proves that he had absolutely no relationship to Islam or Islamic teachings. And they point to other evidence in the literature, some poetry that is ascribed to Yazid, well-known poetry, where Yazid is happy about what he has done after killing Imam Hussein, after ordering the massacre of Ashura. He's happy. We are told in the literature that he recites poetry. He says, "Layta ashyakhi bi badrin shahidu jaz'al khazraj min waq'il asal la ahallu wastahallu farahan thumma qalu ya yazid la tashal." And then he goes on to say, "La'ibat hashimu bil mulki fala khabarun ja'a wala wahyun nazal." He says, "I wish my forefathers, my ancestors from Al-Badr, the Battle of Badr." Who was in the Battle of Badr? Who participated? The Battle of Badr was the first battle that took place after the Prophet migrated from Mecca to Medina. The first battle that took place between the Muslims and the pagans, Quraysh. Leading the pagans was whom? Who was leading the pagans? Abu Sufyan. Abu Sufyan is the grandfather of Yazid. Yazid, the son of Muawiyah, the grandson of Abu Sufyan. He says, "I wish my forefathers, my ancestors, my family members who were there in Badr, who were killed by the Holy Prophet, by Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, by the early Muslims, the companions, I wish they were here. Now, present, they witnessed what I've accomplished, what I've done. لَأَهَلُّوا وَاسْتَهَلُّوا فَرَحًا." They would have been delighted. They would have been very happy to see what I have done. And they would have prayed for me. What? They would have prayed for me and said, "Oh, Yazid, may you be protected." لَا تَشَلْ, meaning what? Literally, it means may your hand never be paralyzed. May you never be paralyzed. And then he goes on to say, "La'ibat Hashimu bil mulki fala khabarun ja'a wala wahyun nazal." That Hashim, Banu Hashim, which is the clan of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, that they deceived everyone. They deceived. They made everyone think that there was a revelation, that there was communication with God, and so on and so forth. They deceived everyone. "Fala khabarun ja'a wala wahyun nazal." He rejects, openly rejects, that there was no such thing. There was no revelation. Now a person who professes this, you don't call him kafir? You don't consider him to be outside the fold of Islam? You don't consider him at least to be a munafiq, a hypocrite? And so they have pointed to this. Now, when we come to the Sunni tradition, we find that many major Sunni scholars, they also adopted this position of condemning Yazid. Some names for those who have interest in the tradition, scholars such as Ibn Aqil, Al-Alusi, Abu Ya'la, Ibn al-Jawzi, the grandfather and the grandson, Al-Taftazani, and many others. They condemned Yazid. Now, some of these, in addition to condemning Yazid, they included cursing Yazid, reciting la'an upon Yazid. What's la'an? Cursing is not using foul language. When we say curse, sometimes there's a misunderstanding. The assumption is when we say curse that it means using foul language. No. Cursing, or la'an in Arabic and according to the teachings, is when one prays to God, beseeches God to remove God's mercy away from someone. Not to have mercy on them. To remove God's mercy. It's a prayer. A la'an is essentially a prayer. It's asking God to remove God's mercy from someone. So some of these scholars, they included, they themselves, they cursed Yazid. And they cursed those who accompanied Yazid, the killers of Imam Hussein, and those who fought under Yazid and under his orders. And others, they wrote specific works, specific books and treatises regarding specifically this topic. One example is the famous Sunni scholar Ibn al-Jawzi, who wrote a book called Ar-Rad ala al-Muta'assib al-Anid al-Mani' min Dham Yazid. It's a refutation of the one, it's unknown, he's not telling us who it is, of the one who is a hard-headed person who insists on not condemning Yazid. He wrote the specific work just for this purpose, to condemn those who do not condemn Yazid. Others, they wrote books specifically regarding the history of Ashura and the Ashura episode and the Karbala massacre. One of the very famous books of Maqtal, Maqtal al-Husayn, which relates all of the events surrounding the killing of Imam Husayn alayhi salam. Very, very famous book and a famous source is written by a Sunni scholar from the 6th century after Hijra by the name of Al-Khawarizmi. Al-Khawarizmi wrote Maqtal al-Husayn. And if you read this, several sections, he begins with praise of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, their virtues, their place, the place of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the place of Fatima al-Zahra, the place of Imam Hussein. He relates the narrations of the Prophet foretelling the killing of Imam Hussein and all of the issues surrounded, all of the wrongdoings of Yazid. It's all recorded. He wrote a maqtal. And there are other works that were written, dedicated by major Sunni scholars, huh? These are not on the periphery. These are well-known scholars who vehemently condemned Yazid, and some of them, they also engaged in the cursing of Yazid. So this is one group. The second group, or the second trend, are those who vehemently condemned Yazid. They criminalized Yazid, but they stopped short of considering him a kafir or a munafiq and or cursing him. They were not happy with his actions. They condemned his actions. They considered his actions to be evil. But they stopped short of translating that into what? Into considering him to be out of the fold of Islam. Or to engage in takfir. Right? Or they stopped short of cursing, doing la'an upon Yazid. And there are some examples. One of the most famous that is considered within the tradition is the example of Ahmad ibn Hanbal. Ahmad ibn Hanbal is the eponym of what would become the Hanbali school of law. And so we are told in some of the sources that one day Ahmad's son Salih, he had a son by the name of Salih, Salih asks his father. He tells him, "Oh my father, what is your opinion of those who admire Yazid? Those who like Yazid, they express their satisfaction or their contentment with Yazid. What is your opinion about them?" And Ahmad is said to have replied, told him, "Oh my son, is it possible for someone who has true belief to like someone like Yazid? To express his loyalty or love for someone like Yazid?" This was the answer of Ahmad to his son. Then his son, he follows up. He tells him, "If this is the case, then do you think it's okay to curse Yazid, to perform la'an of Yazid?" Ahmad here, he answers his son. He tells him, "And when is it that you have ever seen your father curse anyone?" This was his reply. His reply basically was that, "I don't engage in the cursing of anyone." Right? And some have come and they have explained this position and the position of those who refrain from cursing Yazid. Their explanation is that cursing doesn't do anything. It neither brings any benefit nor pushes away any harm. Right? And we can come to the side and talk about cursing and everything, but that's going to take us away from the point. So this is basically the second position. Second position. The third position are those who glorified Yazid. They justified him and his position. They considered him to be a devout believer. They considered him to be a righteous person, an imam. One who was righteous, one who was pious, and one whose actions were justified. And this Brothers and sisters, in truth, this position is a small minority position. If we go back to the records, this is a small, very small minority position of some of the scholars that they justified the actions of Yazid, as well as some contemporary scholars in the modern period. You find this kind of sensibility reappear once again in the contemporary period, especially with those with extremist sensibilities, purist sensibilities, and especially those associated with governments and states. In some parts of the world, in Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries, some scholars who are associated, they are employed by the state. They receive a salary from the state. Their livelihood depends on their employment by the state. And so they justify and they glorify historical figures. Why? Because in essence they are acquiescing and they are justifying the current political circumstances. Because they know if they go back and they open up the old books and they turn to history and they realize the truth of the matter, then what follows? Suddenly the dominoes begin falling, one after another, and then they realize that they're suddenly in the spotlight. They realize now they have a decision to make. Do they justify the actions of their bosses, of their employers, or no? And so this is a small minority position. And sometimes, I think, brothers and sisters, one of the reasons why some of us may have some of these misconceptions and misunderstandings, and when I say some of us, I mean those of various persuasions, is simply because of the times that we live in today. And simply because of the access that we have to this vast network of communication, the internet, where any person with any kind of background, whatever he or she wants, they can get, you know, on the internet, on social media, on YouTube, and they can proclaim any message they want. And usually, the loudest voices are those that are most controversial. They receive the most attention. Right? No one likes someone who's normal, someone who's just repeating something that is not consequential, someone who's not saying something controversial. We all like it. This is why we like TV shows that, you know, highlight sort of those reality TV shows. Why is that so, attractive to some of us? Because supposedly they reveal the real life of people, not this fake life of perfection that they have. They reveal all of their problems, they reveal all of their, you know, arguments, all of their issues. We like this stuff. We like seeing controversy. And so, some of those who are most controversial, but they don't necessarily represent the mainstream view, they receive the most attention. And this influences many of us. Those who spend their time listening to lectures, listening to things on the internet, sometimes it is more likely than not that you will hear things that are controversial, more likely than not. It's just part of the times that we live in. This is why we have to be extra careful. This is why it's so important for us, again, I repeat, that we go back and we study history. We go back and we try to be objective in our understanding. That we refrain from sensationalism. We refrain from reductionism, reducing everything to things that are simple. The world is complex, brothers and sisters. History is complex. We cannot reduce things and make them simple. So these are the three groups. Now, I'd like to make a couple of points. One point is regarding the relationship between faith, iman, and actions and deeds. We find that some within history that they try to distinguish between the iman, the faith of someone, and between their actions. And so when we come to the example of Yazid, we have some who suggest that yes, what he did was horrible, what he did was wrong, but this did not affect his faith. He is still a believer. He is still a believer. He should be considered a believer despite all of the bad things that he did. This is an argument that's made. So what do we say about this? What is the relationship between faith and iman? The relationship simply, brothers and sisters, and this is particularly comes from the teachings and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, where they tell us that faith and action and deeds, they go hand in hand. They cannot be separated. They cannot be pulled apart. They have a reciprocal, not only do they go hand in hand, but they have a reciprocal relationship. That means that they either promote one another or they demote one another. Increased faith causes increased or better quality good deeds and actions, and vice versa. And decreased or less quality good deeds, or God forbid, bad deeds, also affects the iman. There's a reciprocal relationship between iman and action. And the status of a person, brothers and sisters, is assessed and should be assessed on their overall attitude and actions, not on exceptions, not on exceptional cases. Right? Imagine a criminal, any kind of criminal, someone who engages in theft, someone who engages in rape, someone who engages in other kinds of crimes, murder. Imagine this person engage in these acts, but yet he or she, for instance, when it comes to the treatment of his or her mother, they are exceptional in the way they treat their parents and their mother. He goes out, he steals, but then when he comes home, he sees his mother, he runs to his mother, he kisses her hand, he kisses her foot, he wishes her no harm, he wants to take care of her. This is his mother, right? Can we come and we make the argument that, well, the Qur'an, for instance, the Qur'an or the Bible or society tells us that it's good to be respectful to your parents, to honor them, to be kind to them. So this person is still good. They're a good person because they express excessive respect and honor for their parents despite what they do. We can't make this argument. Everyone has some quote-unquote good to them. There is rarely someone who is purely evil, who has absolutely no sense of goodness at all, or no aspect that is positive about them or good about them. Take the example of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a dictator, he was a tyrant, right? But when you read about his life, you are told that Saddam was obsessed with cleanliness. He was obsessed that he is clean in his appearance, in his body, that others, those who surrounded him, they had to be absolutely clean. He was obsessed with this. That sometimes even when he would speak, he would encourage his nation and community to maintain cleanliness. Now, can someone come and say, well, this is an excellent trait? In fact, the hadith says, "At-taharatu min al-iman," or "An-nadhafatu min al-iman." Cleanliness is part of faith, right? This is a popular hadith, we all know it. So can someone come and say, because he was obsessive when it came to his cleanliness, that he wanted everyone to be clean, that he never dirtied anything, that he kept himself clean and pure when it came to his physical cleanliness, that this necessarily means that he is pious, that he has faith? We assess the status of someone on their overall attitude, on their overall actions, not on exceptional cases. And furthermore, when we come to individuals such as Yazid, it was not just a matter of certain crimes, such as drinking, such as engaging in other forms of indecency. I mentioned three major tragedies directly ordered by Yazid himself. The massacre of the Imam on Ashura, the siege on the city of Medina, and all of the crimes associated, and the attack on Mecca. Three major crimes. Three unforgivable crimes. These are kaba'ir. The scholars and the fuqaha, they distinguish between those small sins and what are known as the major sins. The difference between them is not that one is less of a sin than the other. No, a sin is a sin. A sin is a sin. Disobedience. Yet, when it comes to how God treats us, when it comes to the level and the amount of God's mercy and forgiveness towards those who commit minor sins versus major, there's a difference in the traditions. There are some sins that the Quran says God does not forgive. That there is a major punishment, accountability for these actions with God. And what is greater than the killing of the grandson of Rasulullah? What is greater than the killing of the master of the youth of paradise, Sayyid Shababi Ahlul Jannah? What is greater than pillaging, than raping and murdering the Muslims in the city of Medina, the companions and their children and their families? What is greater than this? What is greater than attacking the Kaaba? These are all great crimes. So this is one point. The second point and final point is regarding using religion and using scholarship in order to justify that which is wrong and that which is evil. Unfortunately, this is something that we see within the history of Islam. That there were some from the earlier period, all throughout history until today, some who justified wrong, who justified evil through their use of religion. They used religion as a tool in order to justify all that is wrong. And they did so furthermore through their use of scholarship, through their use of knowledge. They justified wrongdoing. And this is not specific to Islam, brothers and sisters. We find examples in other religious traditions as well. Look at today, our world today. Look at the supremacy. Look at the xenophobia, the racism, the hatred that is justified in society through the use of religion. You have some people who come out and they consider certain political leaders, I won't mention any names, but they're probably playing golf somewhere. They consider them to be what? To be chosen by God. Allahu Akbar. God has chosen them in order to save humanity, to justify all of their ills. And this is not just politicians. Someone might argue that a politician is a politician, right? There's a famous saying in Persian that says that politics has no father and no mother, right? Some might say this is politics, but what about those who are religious leaders? Those who are supposedly knowledgeable of the Bible, knowledgeable of scripture, knowledgeable of what is good and what is wrong. When they use that religion and their scholarship in order to justify what is wrong. We see this in other traditions as well. And so, what is important for us to remember, brothers and sisters, when we assess these things, when we look at these topics, is that the adherence to truth must come first, brothers and sisters. Before everything and anything else, above all else, we are to adhere to the truth, to follow the truth. Not to be partisan, not to be sectarian, not to assume that just because I belong to a certain group or a certain sect or a certain school of thought, that automatically makes me right, and it makes me infallible, and it makes me not prone, not vulnerable to error. We are encouraged and we are mandated to follow the truth. And this is why Imam Ali alayhi salam, he gives us a very beautiful picture. He says, if you want to know the truth, do not follow the people, follow the truth itself. The truth is not known through people, through what they do or what they do not do. The truth is there. There are those who follow the truth, there are those who do not. And so, we are mandated to follow the truth at all, in all cases and at all costs. And the other point is to avoid oppression at all costs. To distance ourselves away. Not only not to engage. Of course, this comes first and foremost. That we should not oppress others. We should not harm others. And when we talk about oppression, we're not talking about just the big things that we steal from people, that we, you know, hurt people, that we abuse people. But even in the way that we interact with one another. The way that I interact with my spouse. The way I interact with my children. The way I interact with my parents, with my family, with the community, with friends, with strangers. That I do not harm someone. I do not oppress someone. I do not be a source of injustice towards anyone or anything. Extend it to other realms of our life, even when it comes to our environment, brothers and sisters. How much injustice and oppression do we put upon our environment, upon this planet that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us? So it's important for us to distance ourselves, not only to not engage in direct acts of oppression or injustice, but to distance ourselves from those who do. And this is why the Quran says, وَلَا تَرْكَنُوا إِلَى الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا. Do not incline towards them. Do not move towards them. Do not associate yourself with them. Why? Because you risk that you will be touched by the fire. What awaits them will also include you. This is what the Quran tells us. فَتَمَسَّكُمُ النَّارِ. You will be held accountable if you incline towards them. Now, unfortunately, what we end up seeing is that some of these attitudes, they, despite the scholarship and those positions that vehemently condemned Yazid, the same was not maintained to his father Muawiyah. In large part, many you find justifying the actions of Muawiyah. The place of Muawiyah, the son of Abu Sufyan, the father of Yazid, despite condemning the actions of Yazid himself. But when we come to the history, we find that Muawiyah was also not innocent. Muawiyah was guilty of many crimes. Look at the way that he dealt with Imam Ali alayhi salam. Just a simple question. Simple question. After the death of Uthman ibn Affan, who did the Muslims turn to as their leader, as their guardian, as their khalifa? They turned to Amir al-Mu'mineen. They turned to Imam Ali alayhi salam. In a period of less than 5 years, Imam Ali only reigned as caliph for 5 years. In this period, three groups, they revolted against Imam Ali alayhi salam. The first of these groups is whom? Who? Who is the first? Huh? No. Not the Khawarij. Muawiyah. He comes and he stands up. He revolts against the authority of his time, the Khalifa of his time, the Imam of his time. He revolts against him. This is no small act. This causes division. This causes death and destruction. This is no small act. This is during the period of Imam Ali. After Imam Ali is assassinated, how does he deal with Imam Hassan? He betrays the Imam. The Imam shows his courage and wisdom by engaging in a peace treaty to secure the lives and the blood of the Muslims. After so many have been killed and massacred, the Imam understands that his position is to secure the lives, his responsibility is to secure the lives of the Muslims. So he makes a peace treaty with Muawiyah. What does Muawiyah do? He betrays. He betrays. He betrays the Muslims and he betrays the Imam. And many sources, they tell us that Muawiyah then engaged in another crime, and that was his involvement in the poisoning and the assassination of Imam Hassan. That he made a promise to the Imam's wife, Ju'da, that if she were to assassinate, to poison her husband, that what would be the reward for this? That she would be married to Yazid. Allahu Akbar. What a beautiful reward. But what did he end up doing? The sources, they tell us that after Ju'da poisoned Imam al-Hassan and he was martyred, that Ju'da came to Muawiyah. She wants to collect her prize. Muawiyah told her, "You think I'm crazy? You want me to give you my son so that you do to him what you did to your former husband, your ex-husband?" And so those days came where Imam Hassan alayhi salam and Imam Hussein, they were together. This was after the death of their grandfather. It was after the martyrdom of Imam Ali. It was after the martyrdom before them of Fatima al-Zahra. And a time where they stood alone, these two brothers who were raised in the same household, who were raised together, who were raised with the Prophet, whom the Prophet would take and he would place one on one side of his lap, the other on the other side of his lap. And he would show them affection and love. Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein, they were alone. Their time is alone after their father. And those days come where Imam Hassan alayhi salam is about to bid farewell. It's his final moments in this life. Imam Hussein comes to visit his brother, his elder brother, Al-Imam Al-Hassan. And he sees him in this devastating state. That the poison has ran through his body. That it has taken over his body. That it is destroying him. He comes to visit Al-Imam Al-Hassan. And the sources, they paint for us a graphic picture of what Al-Imam Al-Hassan is going through. That the Imam begins to regurgitate some of his internal organs because of how severe the poison was. And that the Imam, Al-Imam Al-Hassan, he turns to his brother Hussein. He tells him, "Oh Hussein, bring for me a bowl." Imam Hussein, he brings it forth, and the Imam, Al-Imam Al-Hassan alayhi salam, he's in this state, he's regurgitating his internal organs into this state. As Imam Hussein, his brother, stands, he watches his brother in pain and agony. He tells him, "Oh my dear brother, it is very difficult for me to see you in this state. Why have they done this to you? Who has done this to you in such a wretched manner? This is a very difficult day for me to bear and to experience." Al-Imam Al-Hassan alayhi salam, he turns to his brother Hussein. He tells him, "La yawm ka yawmika ya Aba Abdullah." Allahu Akbar. My dear Hussein, as bad as this is, there is no day like your day, O Aba Abdullah. There is no day and no time like the one that you will experience. As they are in this state, we are told that a Sayyida Zainab alayha salam, she approaches, she comes, she wants to visit her brother Al-Hassan. Al-Hasan, he notices, he turns to his brother Hussein, he tells him, "My dear brother Hussein, I want you to remove this bowl, hide this bowl. I do not want our dear Zainab to see me in this state. This will break her heart, this will be very difficult for her." Allahu Akbar. Zainab alayha salam, she enters, but she sees her brother in that state. She looks over and she sees this bowl that is filled with blood. I don't know, brothers and sisters, which was more difficult for Zainab alayhi salam, to see that bowl on that day filled with the blood of Hassan, or when she would see that platter, that bowl that the head of Hussein alayhi salam was placed in? Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا آل محمد أي منقلب ينقلبون والعاقبة للمتقين. صلى الله وسلم عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله، صلى الله وسلم عليك وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك. عليكم مني جميعا سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت، وبقي الليل والنهار، ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم. altogether. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته. وإلى أرواح المؤمنين والمؤمنات نهدي جميعا ثواب سورة الفاتحة مع الصلوات.